The following program by the LA Sound Posse is Professor Eric Foner's lecture titled The Meaning of Freedom in American History. It was recorded on November 4th of 2005 at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. Eric Foner is DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University.
I want to begin tonight by talking about just a single episode in the history of the idea of freedom in the United States. This was kind of an event or an institution called the Freedom Train, which was a train that traveled around the country in 1947 and 48, a little over half a century ago, carrying 133 cherished documents of American history. The Mayflower Compact, the Declaration of Independence, the Gettysburg Address, and things like that. Never before or since have so many cherished pieces of Americana been brought together in one place. The idea for the Freedom Train originated right after World War II in 1946 with the Justice Department, and it was endorsed by President Harry Truman as a way of contrasting American freedom with what he called the destruction of liberty by the Hitler tyranny. Since direct government funding seemed to smack of propaganda, the project was turned over to a nonprofit foundation called the American Heritage Foundation, whose board of trustees was composed mostly of prominent businessmen, bankers, etc. The Freedom Train was an enormous success. It attracted millions of visitors, and many more took part in public forums and parades that accompanied its journey. It went to about 300 American cities over the course of a year and a half. The powerful response to the Freedom Train, wrote one magazine, revealed a deep popular hunger for evidence of American freedom. But behind the scenes, the Freedom Train demonstrated that the actual meaning of this idea of freedom was not uncontroversial. Because how do you choose which pieces of American history exemplify this idea of freedom? The original list had been drawn up by staff members at the National Archives, and these were liberal New Dealers. They had included initially the Wagner Act of 1935, which was the first law to give workers the legal right to form unions, collective bargaining. They included President Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech of 1941, which outlined the Allied war aims in World War II. You may remember the Four Freedoms were freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from fear, and freedom from want. But the prominent businessmen of the American Heritage Foundation thought that the fourth, freedom from want, sounded vaguely socialistic. So they eliminated the Four Freedoms speech from the Freedom Train. Also taken off the Freedom Train from the initial list were the 14th and 15th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution, which had guaranteed the civil and political rights of African Americans right after the Civil War. In the end, nothing on the Freedom Train referred to organized labor. The Wagner Act was also taken off, or any social legislation. And of the 133 documents, only three made any reference to black Americans. And in fact, African Americans were initially quite skeptical about the Freedom Train. On the eve of the train's unveiling, the black poet Langston Hughes wrote a poem in which he wondered, "Will there be Jim Crow, that is segregation, on the Freedom Train? When it stops in Mississippi," he wrote, "will it be made plain everybody's got a right to board the Freedom Train?" In fact, with the Truman administration about to make civil rights a major issue in the 1948 presidential election, the train's organizers announced that they would not permit segregated viewing. In an unprecedented move, the American Heritage Foundation actually canceled visits of the Freedom Train to Memphis, Tennessee and Birmingham, Alabama, because the city fathers there insisted that black and white visitors could not go on the train at the same time. The Freedom Train did visit something like 45 other southern cities in an integrated fashion without incident, and in the end it was hailed in the black press for breaching, at least temporarily, the walls of segregation. So the Freedom Train reflected a growing sense of national unease after World War II with expressions of racial inequality. As it journeyed along, it also began to reveal the impact of the Cold War on ideas about freedom. As I said, the Freedom Train was initially launched to emphasize the contrast between American freedom and Nazism. But in 1947, a few months before the Freedom Train was unveiled, the Cold War began. President Truman announced the Truman Doctrine, committing the United States to the worldwide containment of communism, and also the Internal Security Program, whereby government employees were brought before little commissions to prove their loyalty. Soon, the Attorney General, Tom Clark, was hailing the Freedom Train as a means of preventing what he called foreign ideologies from infiltrating the United States and aiding the country in, this is a quote, its war against subversive elements. The FBI began compiling reports about people who criticized the Freedom Train or seemed to be unenthusiastic about it. The Freedom Train inaugurated a period, the 1950s, when the language of freedom suffused American culture. This was the period of the free world battling against the communist world. But it also revealed how the Cold War was subtly reshaping freedom's meaning, identifying it more and more with anti-communism, what was called free enterprise, which replaced freedom from want as the economic definition of freedom, and generally the defense of the social and economic status quo. Now, I begin with this little incident of the Freedom Train because it reveals in microcosm the major point, really, I want to make tonight, which is that far from being fixed, the definition of freedom is the subject of persistent conflict and debate in American history. And that story also points to the three issues or themes that I think these debates about freedom have revolved around. One is what you might call the meaning of freedom. And what is your definition? What do you think freedom is? The second is what you might call the social conditions of freedom. Whatever you think freedom is, what kind of social arrangements are necessary in order to enable people to enjoy freedom? And the third is the boundaries of freedom. Whatever you think freedom is, who is entitled to enjoy it and who is not? And why aren't those people who are entitled to freedom allowed to have it? Now, I'm sure you'll agree that no idea is more fundamental to our sense of ourselves as Americans than freedom. This is the central word in our political vocabulary, along with liberty, with which it's usually used interchangeably. The Declaration of Independence lists liberty as one of the inalienable rights of man. The Constitution begins by saying that its purpose is to secure the blessings of liberty. Freedom has often been used as a rallying cry to generate public support in wartime. President Lincoln said the Civil War was being fought to bring about a new birth of freedom. World War II, as I said, was fought for the four freedoms. The Cold War was fought to defend the free world. And the current war in Iraq, as you know, has been given the title Operation Iraqi Freedom. Americans' love of freedom has been represented by liberty poles, liberty caps, and statues of liberty. It's been acted out by burning stamps and burning draft cards, by running away from slavery, and by demonstrating for the right to vote. Obviously, other peoples also cherish freedom. We're not the only country in the world that desires freedom. But the idea does seem to occupy a more prominent place in our public and private discourse than in many other places. The ubiquitous American excuse employed by disobedient children and antisocial adults, quote, it's a free country, sort of an excuse for anything, is not familiar in most other societies. Every man in the street, white, black, red, or yellow, wrote the educator Ralph Bunche in 1940, every man in the street, white, black, red, or yellow, knows that this is the land of the free and the cradle of liberty. And as groups from the abolitionists to modern-day conservatives have realized, to capture, you might say, the word freedom is to acquire a formidable position of strength in political debates. But perhaps because of its very ubiquity or commonality, the history of this idea of freedom is a story, as I said, of debates and disagreements and struggles, rather than a set of timeless categories or a evolutionary narrative toward a fixed goal. And the meaning, the changing meaning of freedom, has been constructed and reconstructed at all levels of society, not only in Supreme Court decisions and congressional debates, but on slave plantations and labor picket lines, and even in people's parlors and bedrooms. Now, if freedom has been a battleground throughout our history, so also has been what I call the boundaries of freedom, the definition of who's entitled to enjoy it. We all know today that the United States was founded as a nation on the premise that liberty is the right of all mankind, but at the same time, it deprived many of its own people at that time of freedom. Efforts to limit freedom along one or another line of social existence have occurred throughout our history. That's fairly obvious. More to the point, or more interesting perhaps, is that freedom is often defined by its limits. Before the Civil War, slave owners insisted that slavery was the best foundation for freedom. that the free person was the person who was autonomous, who did not have to labor, who was not dependent for his livelihood on someone else. Owning slaves made you independent, made you a truly free person. Similarly, the autonomy or independence of men, the lone pioneer, the lone individual out in the marketplace, has often rested on the subordination of women. The independent man often has women and children dependent on him and keeping his household in order for him. Their dependence helps to define his freedom. And for this reason, it's often through what you might call battles at the boundaries of freedom, that is, the efforts of racial minorities, of women, of others, to gain freedom as they understand it, that the meaning of this idea has changed and been deepened. Time and again in our history, the definition of freedom has been transformed by the demands of excluded groups for inclusion. Now, so far, what I've been saying is pretty abstract in general. What I want to do for the remainder of my time is look at a couple of key moments in American history. And I want to look at a few moments in the changing definition of freedom and then talk about what has happened to this idea of freedom in the last 4 years since the terrible events of September 11th, 2001. And I'm going to talk mostly about the 20th century. But of course, Americans in the 20th century were the inheritors of ideas of freedom that went much deeper back in American history. The American Revolution gave birth to an idea about American nationhood and national mission that persists to this day. The founding generation saw the new nation as a unique embodiment of liberty in a world overrun by oppression. That's what Tom Paine said in Common Sense, that great pamphlet arguing for American independence. This was going to be the asylum for liberty for the world. People seeking liberty could come to America to find it from places that lacked it. This is why Thomas Jefferson could call the United States an empire of liberty. Now, in some ways, that term seems to be contradictory. An empire means domination. It means rule over others. But Jefferson said our empire was going to be different from European empires. They were oppressive. Our empire meant the spread of liberty. So the spread of American power, ipso facto, meant the expansion of freedom. This idea of America as an example to the world, of the superiority of free institutions, as you all know, remains alive and well today in our political culture. But as I said, the Revolution also revealed the inner contradiction of American freedom by giving birth to a nation committed to liberty, but resting in large measure on slavery. And freedom is an idea that often is relational. What I mean is, people's ideas of freedom often seem to be defined by some notion of unfreedom or lack of freedom. Sometimes that is identified abroad, like Nazism or Soviet communism. In the 19th century, the definition of unfreedom was here at home. It was chattel slavery. And slavery had a powerful effect on American definitions of freedom. On the one hand, it limited freedom by race. On the eve of the Civil War, in the Dred Scott decision, the Supreme Court declared that no black person could be a citizen of the United States. American freedom was only for white people. The power of slavery created that boundary, that racial boundary around enjoyment of the right to enjoy freedom. But at the same time, the struggle of abolitionists, of slaves themselves, for freedom as they understood it, reinvigorated the notion of freedom as a universal right, not something limited by whiteness. The principles of equality before the law, of birthright citizenship, that anybody born in this country, regardless of race, should be an equal citizen of the United States, those ideas originated in the struggle against slavery. They were written into our laws and constitution after the Civil War, during the period we call Reconstruction. The abolition of slavery in the Civil War reinvigorated this notion of America as a land of freedom, which had been somewhat tarnished by the existence of 4 million slaves before the war. And by the 1880s, the British visitor James Bryce, who wrote a famous book about the United States, was struck by, as he said, the power not only of Americans' commitment to freedom, but their conviction, as he wrote, that they were the only people truly to enjoy it, this sense of American uniqueness in enjoyment of freedom. Now, I'm mostly going to talk about the 20th century. At the turn of the century, what I have referred to as the social conditions of freedom, or what you might simply say as economic freedom, was the major point of debate about what is freedom. And to oversimplify considerably, there were two basic ideas about what are the conditions of life that enable people to be free. One was the social Darwinist view or the laissez-faire view that true freedom exists in the right to compete in the marketplace, that the ability to pursue your own interests, to pursue your own livelihood in a free market without any outside restraint or regulation was the genuine definition of freedom. Critics, however, on the other side, the populists, the labor movement, later the progressive movement, raised the question of whether freedom could really exist in conditions of extreme economic inequality. In the 19th century, economic freedom had generally been defined as independence. I mentioned that. Owning your own farm, owning a shop, not being economically dependent on someone else. But in the industrial age, this no longer applied. Owning a little shop was not the way to really get ahead in a society of large factories, etc. What did industrial freedom, as people talked about it at the turn of the century, what did it mean in a modern society? The critics of this laissez-faire view of freedom said that in a modern economy, economic freedom meant economic security. Sometimes it was called a living wage. Sometimes it was called an American standard of living. But to secure economic freedom defined that way required not government stepping aside from the market, but active intervention of government to uplift those at the bottom of society. Jumping ahead, this idea of freedom as economic security reached its high point in a way during the New Deal of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Roosevelt, as you may know, was the first president to use modern technology, the radio at that time, to bring his views directly into the homes of American citizens through his famous fireside chats. And one of the things he tried to do from the very beginning of his administration was to attach the notion of freedom to the New Deal. In his second fireside chat, Roosevelt juxtaposed his definition of freedom as what he called greater security for the average man with the older notion of freedom as just free competition. And he said that just served the interests of what he called the privileged few. Roosevelt consistently linked freedom with economic security. The liberty of a democracy, he declared, was not safe if citizens were unable to sustain an acceptable standard of living. So Roosevelt invoked liberty or freedom to sustain the New Deal, but his critics in the 1930s also made liberty their fighting slogan. The principal conservative critique of the New Deal was that it limited American freedom by making the government too powerful. When conservative businessmen and politicians in 1934 formed an organization to oppose the New Deal, they called it the American Liberty League. In fact, in 1936, the New York Times wrote of that presidential election that the fight, this is a quote, the fight for possession of the ideal of freedom was the central issue of that campaign. Which idea of freedom was going to triumph, Roosevelt's or his opponents? Roosevelt won, of course, in 1936, but the conservative opposition planted the seeds for a later flowering of anti-statist conservatism, which we see as, of course, very powerful today. Now, often our ideas of freedom are defined in relation to some other example of lack of freedom. In the 19th century, that was slavery. In the 20th century, we have tended to identify unfreedom or threats to freedom abroad. And the point is that these encounters with these foreign examples of lack of freedom have subtly affected the meaning of freedom in the United States. One example of that is the struggle against Nazi Germany, which both it highlighted aspects of American freedom that had previously been neglected, and it also began the process of changing the boundaries of American freedom. Today, if you ask your man or woman in the street to define freedom, they will pretty soon mention the privileges enumerated in the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press, etc. And these were, of course, written into the Constitution in 1791, but for many, many years, many decades, even though those rights were in the Constitution, there was no jurisprudence, there were no legal defenses, really, of freedom of expression, freedom of dissent. At many points in our history, in the 19th and 20th century, there was legal and extra-legal repression of dissenters, of labor organizers, of socialists in World War I, advocates of birth control who were arrested. Many others had found that freedom of expression was limited in American society. It wasn't until the 1930s that the defense of civil liberties began to assume a central place in mainstream definitions of American freedom. And there were many causes for this development, but one was the ideological revulsion, as I say, against Nazism. and the invocation of freedom as a shorthand way of describing the differences between American society and Nazi Germany. As I said, Roosevelt included freedom of speech and freedom of religion, both from the First Amendment, in his four freedoms that were the purpose of World War II. And during World War II, the Nazi counterexample was frequently cited by defenders of civil liberty in the United States. For example, in a famous case when the Supreme Court reversed a previous decision and allowed members of the Jehovah's Witnesses group, well, this was about children from Jehovah's Witnesses families who refused to take the Pledge of Allegiance in school because taking an oath was against their religion, and they were disciplined in school. At first, the Supreme Court had ruled that's too bad, they got to do it, you know, the school has a right to discipline them. In 1943, the Supreme Court reversed itself and said, no, they have the right to dissent. And that's the difference, the court said, between us and Nazi Germany. In Nazi Germany, people do not have the right to express their view or to remain silent against the state, but in the United States, we do. And so that's just one example of how this Nazi counterexample elevated the importance of freedom of speech as a central element of American conceptions of freedom. World War II also helped to reshape debates about the boundaries of American freedom. You may remember that in World War I, the federal government, the Wilson administration, had conducted a vigorous campaign against what they called hyphenated Americanism. That is, they insisted that immigrant groups must prove their loyalty to the nation by Americanizing themselves, by surrendering their old world cultures. You could not be an Italian American or a German American. You had to be an American by entering the great melting pot and sloughing off your old world culture and loyalties. In World War II, the government took exactly the opposite position. The official position of the government was pluralism. What made America distinct was that all groups could enjoy equality and freedom without surrendering their cultures and their identities. The government used the mass media, radio, motion pictures to promote a narrative of American history based on the contribution of all the immigrant groups, and indeed black Americans, to the development of American society. And again, it was the contrast with the theory of a master race, the Nazi race theory, that set the United States in some ways on this road to a more pluralistic vision of American freedom. Racism was the enemy's philosophy. Americanism meant tolerance and equality for all. Now, of course, this ideal was not entirely abided by in World War II. Japanese Americans were deprived of most of their rights as citizens by being interned in camps. The country remained deeply racially segregated. The army was still segregated. But World War II certainly brought a heightened awareness of the contradiction between racial inequality in America and the rhetoric of American freedom. And in fact, my view is it's World War II that launched the modern civil rights movement. We just saw the death of Rosa Parks the last few days, who was certainly a figure worth remembering. But, you know, you don't believe what you see on TV. I guess that's the first point any intelligent person ought to remember. Rosa Parks did not begin the civil rights movement in 1955 when she refused to give up her seat in a bus. There was a long history before that. And the modern civil rights movement, I think, comes out of World War II and the struggles that it unleashed. Anyway, the Cold War, which followed World War II, in some ways was rhetorically a continuation of the Second World War, with communism taking the place of Nazism as the external example of lack of freedom. Once again, the United States was the leader of a global crusade for freedom against its enemy. As the Soviets replaced Germany as the opposite of freedom, as I said before, freedom from want, that is to say, the right of everybody to at least some basic standard of living, slipped into the background because it seemed too akin to socialist ideas. In its place came free enterprise, or in another way of putting it, consumer freedom. That is, freedom meant the ability to choose from the cornucopia of goods produced by the modern American economy. And the high or low point of this equation of freedom with consumerism came at a famous moment of Cold War history in 1959 that is known to historians as the Kitchen Debate. In 1959, in a thaw in the Cold War, the United States and the Russians exchanged national expositions. The Soviets opened an exposition in New York, which featured the products of heavy industry, you know, steel and stuff like this, to show how they had progressed economically. The American exposition in Moscow, which was opened by Vice President Richard Nixon, was an exhibition of consumer goods, cars, TV sets, stereo sets, and the centerpiece was a model of a suburban kitchen with all these labor-saving devices, dishwashing machine, refrigerators, even a little automated floor sweeper. And Nixon opened the exhibition with a speech entitled, What Freedom Means to Us. But instead of focusing on political rights, democracy, freedom of speech, he focused on consumerism. He said, what does freedom mean to us? We've got 56 million cars in the United States. You know, we got 72 million TV sets. You can buy a refrigerator in any color, white, green, mauve, you know, that's freedom. And then as Nixon and Khrushchev, the Soviet prime minister, sort of toured this exhibit, they came to that kitchen and they had this unscripted, impromptu debate. And it was left to Khrushchev, the representative supposedly of a materialist society, to say, surely there must be more to freedom than just accumulating a lot of stuff, you know? And also the 1950s idea of freedom with that kitchen of a suburban home assumed a certain role for women in the American society as basically the suburban housewife. In fact, during the debate, Nixon pointed to the little robot that was sweeping the floor and said, in the United States, you're so free that you don't even need a wife. So the glorification of freedom as the essential characteristic of the United States in this global combat with its enemy opened the door for others to seize upon the idea of freedom for very other purposes. And of course, the most striking was the civil rights movement, or as it called itself, the freedom movement, with its freedom rides and freedom songs and freedom marches and its insistent cry, freedom now. And the civil rights movement took the idea of freedom, which had become a kind of a shibboleth, a slogan of government without a heck of a lot of deep meaning in the 1950s, and reinvigorated it as the rallying cry of the dispossessed. When Martin Luther King Jr. ended his great oration on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in 1963, he ended that speech, the I Have a Dream speech, with a cry from a spiritual, a black spiritual, free at last, thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. He was not referring to just getting the government off your back or owning a gun or not paying taxes, which is what a lot of people think freedom is today. Freedom for the movement meant empowerment, dignity, equality, recognition for a people that had so long been deprived of their rights. Freedom for the black movement was a process. It was an open-ended struggle. It was something to aim for in the future, not something that you are born with and can sort of take for granted. And of course, the black movement strongly influenced the other social movements of the 60s, which all picked up this language of freedom or liberation. And the 1960s sort of pioneered a key transition or transformation in the idea of freedom by pushing it into the most private realms of life, private self-determination. The feminist movement of the 1960s, the so-called new wave of feminism, insisted that there were issues of rights, of equality, of inequality, of freedom and lack of freedom, even in marriage, even in sexual relations, in the most personal of relations, there were issues of people lacking freedom. And even though the political impulse of the 1960s has faded, this idea of freedom as not only the right to choose in the consumer marketplace, but in private matters, is still very prominent in our society today. I think most people think about freedom in some ways as choosing, not a term I like, but one hears a lot, choosing your lifestyle, the right to wear what clothing you want, to wear your hair the way you want, to follow your sexual orientation, whatever it may be. And that's an expansion of the idea of freedom. It's certainly not what the founding fathers have in mind. When Jefferson talked about the United States as an empire of liberty, that wasn't what he was talking about. But it's an example of how the idea of freedom changes and grows and moves into areas that perhaps it wasn't originally intended for. But of course, after the 60s, there was another turn. President Reagan in the 80s, like Roosevelt 50 years before, was a master of communication, of language. And he reappropriated freedom for his more conservative message of free market economics, lack of government regulation. In a way, we still are living, at least in the 1990s, we're still living in the wake of the Reagan Revolution, as they call it. The dominant definitions of freedom nowadays seem to be negations of government, of the notion of a common public culture. negation of individual, you know, any restraint on individual self-determination. In the late 90s, when I was writing a book about all this, I searched the internet one day for sites connected with freedom, and I came up with mostly groups that didn't want to pay taxes, were defending the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms, armed militia groups, groups promoting the sanctity of private property, free trade, etc. There wasn't any site promoting the virtues of big government, for example, as an element of freedom. At the same time, in the 1990s, the collapse of communism led to an unprecedented worldwide expansion of American ideas and internationalization of American ideas about freedom. The free world triumphed over its adversary, the free market over the idea of a planned or regulated economy, and the free individual over the idea of a collective social responsibility. And American ideas of freedom reverberated throughout the world, promoted by a consumer culture and the economic marketplace. Well, in the aftermath of the terrorist attack of September 11th, the language of freedom again took center stage in American public discourse, where it remains to this day. It quickly became the sort of all-purpose explanation for both the attack and the ensuing war against terrorism. Freedom itself is under attack, said President Bush in his speech to Congress 10 days after September 11th. Our antagonists, he said, hate our freedoms, our freedom of religion, our freedom of speech, our freedom to assemble. In 2002, in a speech, the one I'm quoting, he said, he asked, why did bin Laden attack America? The answer, quote, because we love freedom and they hate freedom. And then later in 2002, in calling for increased attention to the teaching of American history, President Bush said, we need to teach American history so that school children can understand that ours is a history of freedom, freedom for everybody. And also in 2002, the government issued a very important document called the National Security Strategy, which is actually on the White House website, well worth taking a look at. This is the document that announced the doctrine of preemptive war, which then led to the war in Iraq in 2003. The National Security Strategy is about international politics and everything, but what's interesting is the beginning of it. It opens not with a discussion of weaponry or geopolitics, but with a discussion of freedom. In fact, it defines freedom. It says, here is what freedom is. Freedom is political democracy, freedom of expression, religious toleration, and free enterprise. These, it says, quote, are right and true for every person in every society. There is no sense, and this is deeply rooted in American history, that other people might have thought about the question of freedom and might have come to their own conclusions. We know what freedom is, and our idea of freedom is right and true for every other person in the world. That's what the National Security Strategy said. It also said that there is, quote, a single sustainable model of society that encourages freedom. That is the United States. There is only one possible model of society that enjoys freedom. It's worth stopping for a moment to reflect on this language, the single sustainable model. The idea of a single model is profoundly illiberal, and I mean illiberal not in the sense of liberal versus conservative, but in the philosophical sense popularized by Sir Isaiah Berlin, a British writer on liberty, who says a liberal society is one in which different models compete for acceptance. In fact, it's totalitarian to say there's only one model of society that can exist. And sustainable, a single sustainable model? What would happen if the entire world actually adopted the American model and consumed energy and emitted carbon dioxide into the atmosphere at the same rate as the United States? How sustainable would life on Earth be in that circumstance? But of course, as during the Cold War, the invocation of freedom has proved to be a very popular rallying cry, even as it sort of subsumes the whole world into an either-or dichotomy. You're either, as the president said, you're either for us or against us. You're either for freedom or against freedom. And as has happened at other times in our history, the current war against terror, the war in Iraq, has also raised the question of how do you fight for freedom, or that is to say, what are the consequences for liberty at home of fighting a war defined as a war for freedom? As has happened during previous wars, we have seen serious erosions of traditional civil liberties. Legal protections like habeas corpus, the right to a trial by a jury, the right to a lawyer, the right to equality before the law, regardless of race or national origin, all these have been curtailed. In the aftermath of September 11th, several thousand people of Middle Eastern origin were arrested, many of them held without charge or without any public acknowledgement of their fate for a considerable period of time. The government has argued in court that even American citizens can be held indefinitely in jail without a charge if the president designates them an enemy combatant. This is a violation of legal traditions that go back to Magna Carta, the idea that you can't just chuck someone in jail and throw away the key. You've got to have a charge, you've got to let them have a lawyer, you've got to have a trial. But our government is still insisting that the president can, by his declaration, strip a person of all his constitutional rights and just keep him in jail as long as he feels like it. But what I find more interesting than that, because this has happened in many American wars, is the widespread popular acquiescence in what I think are some important violations of civil liberties. This was driven home to me, actually, last spring. I don't know if any of you have seen this, but in Washington, D.C., there's this museum called the International Spy Museum, which is a kind of strange place because part of it is history and part of it is James Bond movies and stuff. But I went there because they had an exhibit called Terror in America, 1776 to today. And I wanted to see, you know, it's interesting. Who are they listing as terrorists? And it was a kind of strange conglomeration. There was Timothy McVeigh, you know, who blew up the Oklahoma City Federal Building. There was the Ku Klux Klan. There were anarchists at some time. There was also John Brown, the abolitionist. And there was also the British who burned Washington during the War of 1812, which was sort of uncouth, but it wasn't really terrorism. You know, it was really a war. But the interesting thing was that at this exhibit, they had computer screens where the visitors could vote on various propositions. And the one that struck me was a proposition which said, quote, "The government should have the authority to deport or indefinitely detain people suspected of supporting groups hostile to the United States." Now, let me just point that the government should have the authority to deport or indefinitely detain people not convicted of any crime, but suspected of supporting groups hostile to the United States. What does that mean? There are people who think environmentalists are hostile to the United States. In other words, the government can throw anyone in jail for any time they want if they think they don't like them. That's what the proposition is. As of last January, when I was there, 30,000 people had voted on this proposition. Now, this is not a scientific sample, it's not a Gallup poll, but it's a lot of people. And of those 30,000, 55% had voted yes, and 32% had voted no. So a majority of those 30,000 thought that, again, the government should have the right to just strip people of their basic rights if they suspected them of something, not proved anything, just suspect, not even charged with a crime, just supporting groups. Now, again, what is the point? The point is people are afraid, and history shows that in times of fear, you might say fear trumps liberty all the time. People are willing to give up basic rights if they think their security is endangered. But I think the lesson of that is to remind us that civil liberties are not a permanent, inborn feature of our civilization, but are a rather fragile achievement, which our civility has been won over a long period of time by many, many different groups and struggles, and they're not self-enforcing, they're not self-correcting, and they have to be guarded with great vigilance, even in times of crisis. And we should recall previous episodes in wartime, like the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, or the repression of dissent in World War I, or Japanese-American internment in World War II, to remind ourselves of the dangers of stripping people of their rights, even if it's one particular ethnic or racial group, as happened in World War II, and the dangers that that involves. As Justice Robert Jackson of the Supreme Court wrote in the Korematsu case in World War II, in which the court upheld the internment of Japanese-Americans, in his dissent, he said, "This decision lies about like a loaded weapon, ready for the hand of any authority that can bring forward a plausible claim to an urgent need." In other words, we have to be nervous about governments just claiming the necessity of violating civil liberties because of dangers that might exist. But again, this notion flows automatically almost from the idea that the United States is the embodiment of freedom and that therefore whatever we do is in effect promoting freedom. And the American self-image as the sole defender of freedom in the world has been reinvigorated and promoted very vigorously, as you know, by the government in the last 4 years since September 11th. But I think the idea that the United States or the West in general has an exclusive claim on liberty is a very unhistorical idea. It ignores the recency of the triumph of commitment to freedom in the West and the fact that these values, as I said, are still contested even within our own society. In other words, what I'm saying is that if we just define ourselves as the emblem of liberty and leave it at that, it makes it impossible for us to take seriously dangers to liberty at home, and it makes it also impossible for us to interpret criticism from abroad as anything but hostility to freedom, which is, I think, unfortunately, how much of our government is thinking today. Let me just finish in a minute. I will go back to the 18th century with a quote from Anthony Ashley Cooper, a key Enlightenment figure in Great Britain. In the mid-18th century, when Britain was the most powerful nation on earth, just as we are sort of today, Ashley Cooper commented on the paradox that international power seemed to go hand in hand with a kind of philosophical insularity, a hostility to ideas from abroad. Our best policy and breeding, he writes, it seems, is to look abroad as little as possible, to contract our views within the narrowest compass, to despise all knowledge or learning which is not of home growth. And more than two centuries later, September 11 seems to have produced a similar odd combination of cosmopolitanism, we know we're embedded in the world, and myopia, the demand that we once again emphasize what sets us apart from the rest of the world. Now, shortly before his death in 1970, my PhD supervisor at Columbia University, Richard Hofstadter, gave an interview with Newsweek magazine. 1970 was a pretty volatile time in American life. Hofstadter's interview was a reflection on a society confronting what he called a crisis of the spirit. He said young people had no sense of vocation, no aspirations for the future. They were alienated. But their causes of alienation, he said, well, he didn't really sympathize with the student rebels of the 60s, but he said they had real causes of alienation. He said, quote, you have a major urban crisis, you have this question of race, you have a cruel and unnecessary war, Vietnam. Ultimately, he went on, American society's conception of itself had to change. He said, I think that part of our trouble is that our sense of ourselves hasn't diminished as much as it ought to. In other words, he seemed to be saying the United States needed to accept limitations on its power to shape the entire world. Today, 25 years later, Hofstadter's call for Americans to listen to the rest of the world, not just seek to impose our will on it, seems more relevant than ever. This is difficult for a nation that has always considered itself a beacon of liberty to mankind. But there's another American tradition which is embodied in the Declaration of Independence. If you read that document, you will find that the authors wrote it in order to demonstrate what they called, quote, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind. It's not our job as historians or teachers to tell our fellow citizens what they should think about the world or about freedom. But we should try to insist that discussions of freedom ought to transcend boundaries rather than simply reinforcing or reproducing them. In the wake of September 11th, it's all the more imperative that we develop a candid appraisal of our own country's strengths and weaknesses. The dangers to freedom, not just our enjoyment of freedom, and not simply engage in self-celebration. And if September 11th makes us think more historically rather than mythically about our nation and its history, then maybe some good will have come out of that tragic event. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you. Questions or comments? So yes, sir, right here. The question was, how do I feel freedom will be viewed in the next 10 or 20 years? I think that despite the current focus on the war on terrorism, there are other issues kind of lurking which really will define debates about freedom over the next generation. And those students who are here are going to have to think about, you're the ones who are going to run this society in the future, and I hope you do a better job than our generation has done. I think the question, which was very much on the agenda in the 90s and has slipped off because of September 11th, of globalization and its relationship to freedom. Because traditionally, people's ideas of freedom have come from membership in a nation state. You generally enjoy freedom through your membership, and if you move from one place to another, your rights may rise or fall. But we live in a world now that is getting smaller and smaller, where people in unprecedented numbers are moving, where capital is moving throughout the world. And what does that mean for national institutions? Many conceptions of freedom involve the right to have a say in the basic decisions that affect your life. That's democracy. But today, the basic decisions that affect our lives are made by supranational, either corporations, World Bank, International Monetary Fund, institutions over which no semblance of democratic control exists at all. What does that mean for traditional notions of freedom founded in membership in a nation state? Or another way of putting it is, can there be international concepts of freedom which attach to an individual and are carried with him or her from place to place? There's an international definition, which is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of the United Nations, but that's not enforceable. That's just a statement of principles. In Western Europe, they're moving in this direction. They have a European Court of Justice, which enforces rights over and above individual nation states. In the 1990s, the U.S. was moving somewhat toward getting itself incorporated into this notion of international standards of justice. But the Bush administration, one of their key, even before 9/11, one of their key policy initiatives was to remove the United States from any international standards or judgments about our policy. Remember, it was before 9/11, we pulled out of the Kyoto Treaty on Global Warming, we pulled out of the anti-ballistic missile thing. Since 9/11, we have declared we're not bound by the Geneva Convention of Treatment of Prisoner of War, and we are very much opposed to the establishment of an international court of justice, which is to try international war crimes. The United States does not want to be bound by any international standard of rights and freedoms, which is our right as a nation state. But then that raises the question of what does the notion of human rights mean, and what does the notion of freedom in a globalized world mean if all these things are going to be bounded by national boundaries? So many countries in the world trying to move in this direction of freedoms which are recognized across national boundaries. Unfortunately, this is another one of those areas where the United States is kind of moving away in an opposite direction from the general trend of opinion throughout the world. Yes, ma'am. The question referred to my comment, who started the civil rights movement? Well, there is no one person, obviously. There is a history. It depends. You know, historians have a way of trying to push things back as far as we can go. We could go back to slaves in the colonial era seeking their freedom. We can go back to my colleague Simon Sharma just published a book about the tens of thousands of slaves who ran away to the British during the American Revolution and gained their freedom. An odd way of thinking about American history, that in the Revolution, the Patriots were fighting for slavery and the British were fighting for freedom. And thousands of American slaves gained their freedom by running away to the British. You could talk about the abolitionist movement. But I think the modern civil rights movement, although there are antecedents, NAACP, the modern civil rights movement starts in World War II. In making race a national issue again, on the national agenda. It had been off the national agenda for a century almost since the abolition of slavery. So there's no one individual. Some people might date it from A. Philip Randolph's proposed March on Washington in 1941, which never happened, but forced the Roosevelt administration to create the Fair Labor Practices Commission, which was the first federal agency since Reconstruction dedicated to promoting racial equality in some areas of American life. But this has a long history, and that's why we study history, to find the deep roots of anything that might be happening in the world today. Rosa Parks herself had a history. We should not think of Rosa Parks as a seamstress with tired feet, the way she was mostly described on the TV. This was a political activist. She had been involved in struggles in Montgomery for 20 years before she refused to give up her seat. In the 1930s, she was involved in trying to defend the Scottsboro Boys, who were seven young black men who were falsely accused of rape and put on trial in Alabama. In the 1940s, she was involved with the NAACP in Montgomery. She tried to register to vote in the 1940s. Even though she was a well-read woman, she was denied the right to vote because they kept claiming she failed her literacy test. But she persisted so much that they finally said, all right, already, give her the right to vote. Get her out of here. She's a pain, you know? She was one of the few black people in Montgomery who actually got the right to vote in the 1940s. She went to the Highlander School in Tennessee in the 50s, in the early 50s, which was a place where communists, socialists, unionists, civil rights activists gathered to plot strategies for attacking Jim Crow. So this was a seasoned political veteran. That doesn't mean that her refusal to give her a seat was kind of planned or part. No, it probably wasn't. But she wasn't just a simple, ordinary person who didn't want to get up. Her history is part of the history of the civil rights movement. So even that didn't begin in 1955. Yes?
You mentioned corporations, and the people who speak on behalf of corporations today would argue that they have freedoms. And I wonder what your thinking is about how that perception has changed over the years.
Today, as always, there are numerous competing definitions of freedom out there, and the very corporations and indeed the government, both the Bush administration and the Clinton administration and the Bush administration before that, have all insisted that freedom in the economic world means the right of companies to shift capital around as they see fit, to shift labor around as they see fit. Any restrictions on their right to do so is a drag on American competitiveness and productivity. And so, you know, as we see today, what they used to call the sort of social contract after World War II, the labor contracts which guaranteed people medical insurance, pensions, these are all being stripped away now. Company after company is just abandoning their pensions. People who worked for 20, 30 years are suddenly finding that, wait a minute, my pension is gone, you know, the corporation just abolished it. Healthcare is being taken away from many people. So, yeah, you have a clash of freedoms. You have the freedom, the old idea of freedom as security, of economic security as the basis of freedom. And it's not just an American idea. The Nobel Prize winning economist Amartya Sen wrote a book a couple of years called Development as Freedom, in which he said, the greatest threat to freedom in the world today is not terrorism, it's not Osama bin Laden, it's poverty. Poverty deprives people of the ability to enjoy freedom. That's one view. The other view, the corporate view, is no, freedom is the ability to compete in a marketplace without restraint. And so in a democracy, it's up to the majority of the people to decide what they think freedom is. And that, I hope, will be a debate in the future. That's all, you know. No one of us can determine what it is. Yeah, and that's a great question. The question was, citing the historian Niall Ferguson, who has written several books calling for the United States to take up the burden of empire, which the British had benevolently, he said, in the 19th and 20th centuries. The world is disorderly, the world is chaotic, the world is full of dangers. It needs some power to create order and progress. And that's what empire is. Now, Ferguson also says he doesn't think the United States is going to do it. He thinks we're too cheap, basically. It's very expensive to run an empire. He doesn't think we're willing to pay the price. He doesn't think we have the attention span. Ferguson is British. He has a great nostalgia for the days of the British. You know, it's funny, a lot of these guys demanding American empire are actually Brits who are looking for an empire. You know, they lost theirs, and they come over here, and they say, okay, well, maybe America can have a nice empire. But again, this idea is deeply rooted. You know, in 1898, when the United States became an overseas empire by acquiring the Philippines and Puerto Rico and Cuba for a little while from Spain in the Spanish-American War, President McKinley said exactly what this questioner said. We are a benevolent empire. We are not oppressing these people by ruling them. We are bringing them democracy and progress. And that's what we hear today. The problem is that the people at the receiving end often don't see it the same way. The Filipinos did not welcome benevolent imperialism. They did not see it as benevolent. In fact, they fought a very vigorous war for several years against the United States, trying to establish their national independence. And the Cubans, who had been fighting a war for national independence for quite a while before the United States intervened, were very bitter about the United States kind of sticking around. And eventually, we left in 1901 or 3 or something, but we stuck into the Cuban Constitution a provision that the United States had the right to intervene anytime it wanted in Cuban affairs. And, you know, my answer to Ferguson is that the imperialists always think they're being benevolent. You've never heard, maybe Genghis Khan or somebody, you know, Attila the Hun said, no, I'm just coming in to massacre everybody. But imperialists don't say that. They're always bringing progress and civilization and uplift in their own rhetoric. And of course they do to some extent. The United States built a lot of roads and schools and stuff in the Philippines, you know. But we had a very benevolent empire here in the 18th century. The British Empire was pretty unoppressive to American colonists, but that didn't stop the Americans from desiring their own independence. So I think one has to try to look at this from both directions, from the point of view of the benevolent imperialist, but also from the point of view of those on the receiving end who tend not to welcome outside dictation about how they ought to be running their own affairs, basically. Any other questions right over there? Don't ask, don't tell. Okay, the question has to do with the famous policy introduced by President Clinton regarding gays in the military. Don't ask, don't tell. In a more general sense, the gay movement, which is sort of the last, in a sense, you might almost say, of the movements that came out of the 60s, has definitely had an impact on people's views of freedom. What the upshot in the military is a little hard to say, because the military exists in its own little special legal world, and things can be done in the military which couldn't be done, you know, outside. I mean, people in the military can't always have freedom of speech, let's say. But certainly in 2003, the Supreme Court, in a famous case called Lawrence v. Texas, overturned the Texas law making homosexual acts illegal, basically. And Justice Kennedy, in that decision, kind of answered your question, because he said, this is a question of freedom, he said, exactly. Now, he didn't claim that the question of people's right to sexual self-determination was what the founding fathers had in mind when they wrote the Constitution. Obviously, it wasn't. But he said, our ideas of freedom expand and change over time, and more people are brought into it, and new groups are brought into it. And this recognition of the rights of homosexuals is part of the ongoing growth of freedom in America. So I have no doubt that 50 years from now, homosexuals will serve in the armed forces without any problem, one way or without. Don't ask, don't tell, don't do anything. They'll just be assumed to be regular people in the army. I have no doubt, many people may disagree with me, that gay marriage will be taken for granted 50 years from now. If you don't think that's true, just look 50 years ago. In many, many states in this union, interracial marriage was against the law. Up until, when was it 67, the Loving decision? It was only in 1967 that the Supreme Court invalidated numerous state laws banning marriage between black and white people. Is there anyone today who thinks that people should not be allowed to marry across racial lines if they are in love with each other? No, it's taken for granted today. It was anathema to millions of people 50 years ago. So our ideas of freedom do change. One hopes they expand, but one of the lessons of our history is sometimes they don't expand. Sometimes they go backward. Sometimes people who enjoy freedom lose it. And that's why we can't take it for granted. We have to be ever vigilant about restrictions on our own liberty. Maybe we can have time for one more question, okay? And then we will call it a day. Over here. Political correctness and freedom is the question. Well, I believe strongly in freedom of expression. I also believe in courtesy. I don't see any point in directly insulting someone. I don't see what that gains you, or saying something to someone you know is going to be offensive or make them angry. But political correctness is a term which I think maybe ought to be retired for a while. It's kind of been so extended and used in so many contexts that I'm not even sure exactly what it means anymore. In an educational context, which is where I mostly exist, it's tricky. On the one hand, there have been a lot of debate about speech codes at universities. Should you be allowed to say something that's offensive to someone else? I mean, my personal view is to have the greatest possible latitude in freedom of expression. On the other hand, in a classroom, there are limits. I don't think a teacher who uses insulting language to a student or who denigrates the race or religion of students, I don't think that's freedom of expression. I think that's violating his role or her role as a teacher to create an atmosphere in which people can learn. So is that political correctness if someone should be reprimanded for that? Or is that just what the job of an educator is, to try to enable everyone in the classroom to learn? And if you tell your class that some people are inferior, that's a violation of your job as a teacher. Generally speaking, though, I tend to favor as much freedom of speech as possible. But what's interesting today, I think, and I'll end with this, and I have experienced this in my own life a lot lately, is that traditionally, threats to freedom of expression have come from the government. I mean, after all, the First Amendment is to prevent the federal government from suppressing your freedom of expression. And then later on, courts also applied that to state governments. But the First Amendment doesn't apply to private actors. But I think today there are dangers to freedom of expression which arise out of organized public groups. The internet and other things make it very easy to mobilize. I lecture to teachers a lot around the country in doing that tomorrow here in these Teaching American History grants. I have heard many teachers say in many different places, states all around, you know, talking about political correctness, if I say something in class which somebody thinks is critical of the administration or of the war, the next day there'll be parents calling the principal saying I should be fired. That's a kind of patriotic correctness, which I think is much more dangerous today. The notion that criticism equals being un-American or anti-American. And there are many groups out there which are now mobilized to try to intimidate those people who express dissenting views. I know this myself because I sometimes write for a magazine called The Nation, which is quite critical of the administration. Whenever I do so, I get a bunch of threatening emails. Now, a threatening email isn't like a guy walking up to you with a gun in the street. It's not really that frightening. But self-proclaimed patriots who are willing to fight to the death for freedom and yet insist that no one else should have the right to freedom of expression. That is a danger in this country today, and I think we need to be very vigilant against it. Anyway, thank you all for coming.
You have been listening to Professor Eric Foner presenting his lecture, The Meaning of Freedom in American History. It was recorded on November 4th of 2005 at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse.
The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.